Alrighty, good evening. This is WOBC 91.5, Oberlin College and Community Radio. You're listening to The Weekly, a roundtable show devoted to discussing current events and news happening in Oberlin. And tonight, I'm pleased to say we have a couple of guests. I am here with the esteemed editors from the Oberlin Review, and we're going to be discussing a number of topics from the weekly paper, including the recent hiring freeze on faculty, and a couple of other things, which we will get to. So first, just to start off, we can do introductions. I'm Johan Cavert. I use he, him, his. I'm a staff writer for the Review and host of the weekly. And we have...
My name is Sydney Allen. I am the news editor at the Review. I use she, hers, and I'm a junior.
And it's your other co-host, Daniel Marcus. I am the managing editor. Yeah.
Excellent. Well, thank you all for being here. And as always, I should say before we get into things, we're so glad that this is a live show. Hopefully in the future we'll get some pre-recorded stuff. But at the moment it is live, and that means you can call in if you have input or commentary. We'd love to hear from you. Please give us a ring at 440-775-8139. And yeah, if you have suggestions about future topics or things you'd like discussed, things you've seen going on in Oberlin, please give us a ring. So now we're going to get to the first topic of tonight, and that is the hiring freeze. So I know, Sydney, you wrote the front page story for the Review this past week, talking about the hiring freeze that's currently going on for faculty. Would you mind setting up the story for us, sort of the background, the basics?
Sure. Well, obviously, the hiring freeze has resulted out of Oberlin's financial situation. And we received this information. We'd been hearing from many faculty members that there were a lot of unfilled positions that were, not being looked at on campus, and a lot of faculty members are very concerned about this. And so we talked to Dean of Arts and Sciences, Tim Elgren, and he kind of explained to us what exactly the college was thinking of doing about it, and that is how the hiring freeze came about.
Sounds good. Do you want to add anything to the basics, Dean? No? Okay. Well, I guess I'm curious sort of how this plays out. I know you said that a lot of it is due to the recent $5 million deficit that Oberlin has received. When you were talking to the various faculty members, did they, what was sort of their take on it, their perspective?
Yeah, well, I mean, for many of these faculty members, you know, the larger implications of having a huge deficit, that can be kind of secondary to actually running a classroom and running a department and making sure that students graduate with the skills and, you know, degrees that they need. And so a lot of them were pretty upset that they didn't think this was the correct answer. Some of these positions are vital, and not having full-time tenure-track faculty members can be a scary prospect and a intimidating one when you're looking at, a couple tenured professors teaching more students than they should probably physically or, you know, practically be able to do.
Can you talk about maybe any departments that have specifically been impacted by this in a significant way?
Sure, yeah. The geology department, they're looking at a pretty scary situation next semester. They had a retirement, I believe it was either last year or a couple semesters ago. And that position has still not been filled. And they were pretty outraged because they had gotten a tenure track position approved and they were all set to, you know, begin the search process of actually filling that with a qualified candidate. But they had to, once the hiring freeze was announced, obviously that was no longer the case. And they had to kind of halt that process until it is resolved.
Yeah, no, that's great. I guess I was hoping maybe we could walk it back even a little bit and take it right to the basics of sort of where how the faculty hiring, you know, usually works in a normal situation. Do you, either of you, know sort of what the basics are, what the general roles are? I know that, like, in the article we talked about tenure track, visiting professors. Would you mind speaking to the difference between those?
Sure. Yeah. So visiting professors tend to only stick around for a year or two, and those are intentionally short-term positions, while tenure-track professors are long-term. They're budgeted for longer. They are their salaries are compensated based on that fact, and they just have a different responsibility load, I suppose. Does that help?
Yeah, no, that's great. Yeah. Sweet. So, sorry, just looking at my notes here. I guess another question, sort of follow-up that, is how that, you know, we talked about how it's affected faculty. Are there ways that this is already affecting students other than, you know, some departments just being short-staffed? Is it going to play out in what classes are available, things like that?
I mean, I can't speak to how it'll affect what will be available. I don't think we're quite at that point yet where faculty members are going to have to start deciding, like, who teaches what. But, I mean, certainly, I think from a student perspective, especially if you're going to major in a certain subject, it is much more appealing to take a course from a long-term tenured faculty member than someone who will only be there for a short period. And I mean, so much of a major is about their relational aspect that you build with a professor and with people who are very experienced and connected in that world. And I mean, we have some very talented visiting professors, but I don't think it has the same sense of security that a tenured professor does.
That's an interesting point that you're making there, because I have been thinking a lot about this, and I guess before I sort of discuss how I feel about it, could you maybe take us through the strategy that is underlying this? Because this is, you know, from what I understand, this is not the kind of situation where we have to immediately cut three positions, and that's not happening. What's happening is there are many more positions than need to be held open are being held open. Can you explain why that's happening?
Sure, of course. So based on my understanding with my conversations with the administration, the goal with this whole hiring freeze is to gather as many open positions as possible, and open in terms of being currently filled by visiting or temporary professors. Positions that might otherwise be filled with tenured. And the reasoning behind that is, I mean, the college is eventually going to have to make some decisions based on, you know, are they going to keep certain positions? Are they going to sunset certain lines within a department? And lines being a budget line for a professor of some sort. And so sunsetting a line would be eliminating an open position and not replacing it with anyone for on a long-term basis.
Okay. Right. Because I personally, I'm not, you know, I don't know anyone in administration well enough to really be able to say this outside of my own opinion, but it sort of feels a little bit wrong to me, I think, that's the way it's going down. Like, I understand the logic of, let's, you know, keep as many holes open now as we can so that when it comes time for us to make a decision, like, we have as many choices as we need to do that. But I think that's a kind of a scary prospect, because it means, to me, what it means is that, you know, you're going to have departments where people who are thinking about retiring or accepting other positions might not do so out of fear that is going to bode poorly for their department. You're going to have, I imagine, departments sort of reconsidering their budgetary priorities in a way that they might not otherwise. And so for me, I think it represents, I'm concerned about this because it represents a really marked shift from business as usual that is undoubtedly going to impact the way departments conduct themselves. Johan has a comment.
Yeah, I was just curious. It's sort of from the perspective that you're taking on it, it seems like you think it's going to be a long-term decision or a long-term freeze. And when I was reading the article, it seemed to me that like the Board of Trustees is going to meet this upcoming weekend, and that their decision is going to play a role in that, and we're going to have to sort of see where we go from there. But it didn't seem maybe like as long term a decision that it would affect like budgets and things like that.
I don't really mean long term. I just mean in the sense that we are that the decision is being sort of put off in a sense. Or being prolonged. I don't think this does not feel to me like the right kind of proactive action, I guess. Maybe Sydney, you have some thought on that.
Yeah, no, I definitely do. No, well, first off, I definitely agree with Johan that I don't think this is going to be a long-term, I guess, freeze. Based on my conversations, it was insinuated that this could be done as early as, say, January, or hopefully. And so I kind of disagree with you, Daniel. I saw it is a pretty smart decision that they were willing to, you know, make all of these options and not be, I mean, if they didn't, think about some of the implications of that. Like, you could be, if you only had three positions and it was three tenured track professors in, like, chemistry, bio, and English, and you had to eliminate one of those positions, or one of those lines, excuse me, then you would have to make a very difficult decision as to, you know, we're going to cut something to the detriment of our major. We're not going to have enough people to offer this certain thing. So I respect the fact that the administration is willing to kind of create options, even if it creates some short-term discomfort.
Right. I guess I was more coming at it from the perspective of, like, why are we not sort of strategizing about which positions seem the most, and maybe this is happening behind closed doors and we just sort of don't know about it, but I'm coming at it from the perspective of, like, instead of, you know, giving ourselves an array of options for the short-term detriment, but for the long-term benefit, why not do something which is a little bit intermediate between the two, where you're considering, you have sort of a short list. That way you can hire for the departments that really, really do need a hire, or the departments that, like the geology department, were promised a hire was going to happen and then didn't get one. I just feel like there maybe is a little bit of a middle ground that is not being sought.
No, yeah, and that's a very good point. And I know, I mean, from my perspective, part of that issue is that there hasn't been very much student involvement. And I don't know if you'll remember from the article, but there are certain groups like the geology co-chairs who are planning to, you know, write letters to the administration and start actively trying to figure out what is going on, because for many students, they just see half of my professors are leaving for sabbatical or leave or something, and we aren't getting any more permanent positions. So this is kind of a scary prospect that they aren't getting the information from, you know, any administrative leaders, but they do see this kind of tension building among the academic departments.
I think that's a really good point, that sort of students weren't necessarily considered in this. I mean, I think I totally agree with Sydney that this seems like a pretty smart way to go about it, given a lot of hard, you know, economic decisions and things like that. I think it makes a lot of sense to get rid of lines that don't exist other than having to make those tough decisions. But I would say I think the downside of that, sort of what Daniel was getting to, is that then it seems like the positions that are, you know, not existent or less likely to exist in the future are the, like, random things that happen to be who retired or, you know, who was just, like, already looking for a new tenured position. So is that sort of the case? Does this negatively impact, like, those random, you know, random departments that had someone leave and just weren't expecting a hiring freeze to take place? Is it equally, you know, is it going to hurt departments equally across the board?
I mean, I guess that would definitely depend on the department. I know there are some departments that haven't, that have been fortunate enough to not have any faculty, you know, retire or anything like that in recent semesters. But, I mean, I know at the beginning of the semester, we reported on Chris Canavan's letter, and I think it's very much, you know, every single department at the school is going to be looking at their budgets and looking at ways to cut costs. And the general faculty council made of every single professor at the school, they're very much aware of the financial crisis and their role that they're going to have to play in that. So I say it is pretty evenly distributed among all faculty members, at least in theory.
In theory, I guess it is. I think my question is, and again, it may be sort of unknowable for all of us, but I'm a little skeptical that, you know, this is not the kind of situation where, I'm a little bit skeptical that there are not, you know, maybe some departments out there that actually could shed maybe a staff position. That aren't going to, because of the timing happens to be good for them, where you have maybe another department where actually the timing is really, really bad and they really need a staff position, but now they're in the consideration because of the timing. So that's sort of how I feel about it.
I mean, one thing that was made very clear to me was that this process is not about firing professors or letting people go or cutting things in that kind of very punitive, drastic way. And so I can't speak to situations where that might be the case, where some department just gets lucky, even though they have everyone there. But I do definitely agree with you that some of it is just the luck of the draw and that some departments are definitely going to be hurting a little bit more than others right now.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any sense, Daniel, I know you've been talking some about this, but other areas in which there's sort of disparity between the finances of departments? You had been, am I wrong writing about this?
You're right.
Okay.
Yeah. So this is a little bit of an older piece of reporting, but there is, and Cindy can shed a lot more light on this than I can, but there is, sort of a historical discrepancy between certain departments, ones that tend to be older and more well-reputed, like English and chemistry, having much more significant budgets because of endowed funds, for example, than a lot of newer departments, like, for example, gender, sexuality, and feminist studies, for one. So I think the chemistry example comes to mind just because that's the department that I'm in and it's the department that I know. And we actually just hired at the end of last spring, a tenure track faculty member. And so the timing for us was really, really good. Whereas some departments, I know theater is an example, are not able to make the hires that they need to. Theater is building a new production facility. They do not have the ability to hire because of this freeze to staff that facility adequately. But Sydney, I think, probably can talk more about that sort of thing.
No, yeah, I think you definitely just summarized it very well, because the crux of the issue is that some departments are much better resource than others, and that has nothing to do with necessarily college funding, but a lot of it comes from a lot of these older departments, just like what you said, English and history. They have a large base of donors, a large long history of people, you know, going on from the major, being successful, and then donating, leaving endowments, leaving funds for certain things. I know the English department, for instance, They have a, this is just one kind of silly example. They have an endowment just for original works of Shakespeare from different productions. Like, I think, and I don't remember, the budget was either, I think it was upwards of $50,000 just for this particular, very specific issue. And the endowment had, they've had it, I think he said, it was at least over 50 years old. Excuse me for not having the notes in front of me. But, yeah, and so that particular budget, the library every once in a while will just find an original work or an original, you know, text or something they would like. And they'd like, oh, I'm going to draw from this fund. But otherwise, it's just sitting there collecting interest. And they aren't able to use it for any other purpose besides, you know, these manuscripts, these books, and because that's how endowments work.
Wow, that's, yeah, that's a very intriguing fact and sort of ridiculous. But just to bring it back to the hiring freeze, I guess, I think we've been talking about this, and clearly it's a really important topic. I'm glad that the review covered it. I'm glad we're doing it tonight on the show. I guess Sydney already sort of glanced on this and said that there's some geo majors,
yes,
planning to write about, you know, write to the administration and say how this is affecting them. Are there other ways that students can get involved? Do you know of anything, or is it just?
I mean, I know these students in particular are planning on writing letters to Tim Elgren, the Dean of Arts and Sciences. But I think a lot of the responsibility, per se, is going to fall on student department reps, because as these pressures kind of build, I know some of the students I was talking to were discussing ways that they can support their professors, and that's a large part of what's on their minds, like how they can be there for them as these pressures mount, as, professors get spread more and more thin because, you know, there are less tenured professors in each department than, say, we've had in years past.
This is another, I think, important area, because one thing that Johan and I have talked a lot about on this show in the past is what duty, if any, the Board of Trustees and the administration has to inform students of these issues as they're coming up. From my perspective, this feels very sudden and unexpected, and it feels like something that has not been stated very clearly and plainly, unless you are a department rep for a certain department that is having issues with getting a staff member because of the hiring freeze. Does that sound accurate to you?
No, I think that's entirely the case. I mean, I think there is so much information that only certain groups on campus know. Like, you know, the review, we we get told things by sources. We do interviews. Like, I feel like we have a fairly good grasp on what's happening with the college's financial situation. You know, Senate has a good grasp, but the average student that you'll find on the street, they don't get that information. There's no way. And a large part of that is by joining committees and, you know, becoming involved in college politics and such. But that's, for a lot of students, that's a pretty tall order to fill.
Mm-hmm. Just a quick follow-up to that, to get the basics. Was this announced publicly? How was the policy sort of rolled out?
This was not announced publicly. Tim Elgren will be discussing it more with faculty members this Wednesday during the general faculty meeting, but it has not yet been talked to. I mean, students have no way to learn about this besides, I suppose, our article. And that could obviously change after Wednesday, but at this point, I mean, we don't know.
Yeah, that's one thing that I really sort of itches me about this, is that, you know, yeah, it could be a coincidence, but it doesn't feel right for that to me that much. And I think like one thing that I've heard a lot, because we've talked about sort of, it's been a recurring issue of, you know, how much students should get to know, like, explicitly and just be told without having to ask. And I think for me, it keeps coming up as being the case that, you know, the thing, some change is happening, and it should definitely be one that students know about, and they don't hear about it unless they sit on a faculty committee or they sit on, you know, their major reps committee, or they sit, you know, at a certain point, everyone who's a geo major deserves to know what's going on with the fact that they can't hire a new professor, because I have a feeling that there are a lot of geo majors, or, you know, name any other department that's having trouble with hiring. I'm sure there are a lot of geo majors who might not want to sit on the rep committee, but who might want to know what electives are going to be offered in the future, or if there are going to be electives, or a substantive number, I should say, offered in the future, and how that's impacted by the fact that they can't hire. It just strikes me as something where full disclosure is needed and it's not being given.
Yeah, I guess I would agree with that. I think it's probably not quite the evil administration that Daniel,
I don't believe the administration is evil. I just feel like there's a need for disclosure and it's not being met.
Yeah, I think that's true. I don't think it's a malicious intent, though. I think that the administration has a lot going on. There's a lot of economic challenges. I think another point probably is that Oberlin students are, you know, have a good reputation for being activists and speaking out. And if they, there's probably, you know, like, this maybe isn't the best thing to acknowledge, but is that if you've got a unpopular policy, if you keep it under wraps a little bit, then it's not going to make as much noise, and that there's not necessarily, it seems like, a great way to do this. Like, this seems like, with what they have, probably one of the better ways to do it. So that's maybe not as popular an opinion, but a little defense. I don't know.
Yeah. And one thing that I've talked about with some professors who are very much kind of a counter argument to Daniel, what you've been saying, I think there are quite a few opportunities where this information is disseminated, like among departments specifically. But I think there's an issue in the way that information is being communicated. I think there's a certain amount of buy-in that needs to happen with students, where you know, they may have to attend certain geology department meetings that they wouldn't necessarily go to otherwise, or they may have to check their email, for instance, which we recently found out was not something that students enjoy doing, or that's not a preferred method of communication. Yeah, and so I think that presents some added challenges in how that information is disseminated.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you have thoughts or opinions, comments, please let us know. We'd love to hear from you. We don't just want to take up all the time gabbing up here in WOBC, but we're happy to do that or hear from you. You can give us a call. Again, the number is 440-775-8139. Call in, tell us your thoughts about the recent hiring freeze on faculty. We're going to take a short break here, but one last question.
So one last question for Sydney. We've talked about, you know, the board is going to meet this coming weekend and discuss this, probably among many, many things that they'll be talking about. My question would be, after this weekend's board meeting, where do we go from here? What happens going forward? Are we going to have any sort of immediate resolution? Is there going to be some kind of, like, narrowing down process that occurs? What do things look like going forward?
I definitely think there's going to be a narrowing down process, like you said. I don't necessarily know how much students will see that. I think there's going to be a lot of conversations happening among groups that most students do not necessarily have access to, like the EPPC, I believe it's the education policies and, excuse me, I don't remember the acronym, but committees like that that do have student seats open that only a couple students who happen to be student senators take up. So I think these conversations are happening, but it's going to be pretty difficult for that information to get around to everyone.
Great. Follow up to that. Seems like there's going to be a lot of important decisions being made this upcoming weekend at the Board of Trustees. Since we're in the studio with some review experts, do you guys have things planned for how you're going to get info? Do you have interviews or things scheduled?
I do.
Nice. All right. On top of it.
Yeah.
Well, you can tune in or read the paper next week. There's going to be probably some big news coming out of this that will be sure to impact the future of Oberlin College and its finances and its policies. So we're excited to hear more about that. Again, you are listening to WOBC 91.5 FM, Oberlin College and Community Radio. Thank you so much for tuning in to the weekly. We're going to take a short break here, listen to an interview with a conversation with Emily Nussbaum, a graduate in 88, very kindly produced by WOBC News. So we'll get back to more conversation about local news and events after that. Thanks so much.
You're listening to WOBC News, broadcasting from Oberlin, Ohio, every even hour, every weekday.
On the WOBC News Hour on Sunday, April 23rd, the news team had a fun and interesting interview with Oberlin alum Emily Nussbaum. Emily is the television critic for The New Yorker, and in 2016 won the Pulitzer Prize for Criticism. She's written about The Good Wife, Girls, Mad Men, and Scandal, among other shows. Previously, she worked at New York Magazine for 7 years, editing the culture pages and creating the approval matrix and writing both features and criticism. Stay tuned for our conversation with Emily, where we discuss the nature of binge watching, especially a new controversial show, Girl Boss, as well as our thoughts on the place of teen shows on TV and the legacy of Lena Dunham's six-season hit HBO show, Girls. So, first off, I just want to ask you how you think your time at Oberlin either helped or hurt your career.
You know, I'm not sure. It was so long ago. I'm so old. I'm thinking about it. I mean, I had a good time at Oberlin. It was really valuable to me. I learned a lot of stuff. I have a lot of friends from Oberlin, and it was a good school for me to go to. I liked that it was small, and I did cool things in my winter terms, and I have good memories, but I don't know whether I would specifically connect it with my career, because a lot of times people ask me, so did you want to be a television critic when you were in college? And I was like, that would make no sense, because TV was entirely different when I was in college.
Yeah.
I mean, not that there were no good, I mean, there were a lot of good shows on in the 70s, and there were some interesting things on in the 80s, but I went to school from 84 to 88, and it was not exactly prime time for ambitious television.
That's actually interesting. And you talk about the changes between TV when you were in college and now. And I'm wondering how, you know, the new way to watch TV, like on Netflix, on our computers at 4 a.m. on a tiny screen, you know, has changed perhaps how you look at TV in terms of your criticism.
Yeah, it's changed it radically. And When I think about when I really started getting into, I wrote about TV a bunch in the 90s because there were a set of shows that I was interested in, but I really became personally interested in arguing about and then later writing about television around 1999, 2000. And I actually think that's when TiVo came out, if I'm remembering correctly.
Oh,
and
yes.
I think there's no separating the development of TV as an art form from the changes in TV technologically. They're the same. My era of becoming a television critic has all been about the ability, to a certain extent, to pause TV and rewind it and store it, which was a new thing. I mean, when I was growing up,
yeah,
it was all live, by and large. I mean, if you ever tried to program a VCR, you would know that it was essentially live. Like,
right,
it was very hard to do. So I'm really wrestling with this. I mean, I love it to some extent. There are upsides and downsides.
No, that makes sense. It's also very dangerous when, 13 episodes in season one is released. I know some people on the news team have been binge-watching the show Girl Boss lately. Have you seen that?
Wait, God, you're the fourth person to mention Girl Boss to me in 2 days, and I have heard that it is not a good show.
It's awful. It's like, it's really so bad.
People are clearly watching it, so it's definitely speaking to some sort of desire, and I don't know whether it's, I mean, I have to watch it. I have no opinion of it artistically until I watch it. Maybe I'll love it, but it's funny, my babysitter was saying to me last night, have you watched Girl Boss? And somebody else said to me,
I think it's essential.
I think there's something about the title, and there's something about, first of all, the timing is impeccable somehow. Like,
yeah,
girls
absolutely.
Going off the air, and not that they're the same thing, they sound like very different shows.
But, very, very, very different, yeah.
The desire to see a young woman who is, I don't know, like just the adventures of a particular kind of ambitious young woman mm-hmm. in an urban setting, like seems strong. And obviously there are different shows that satisfy that in different ways, but maybe there's even something about the slickness of this. But it just, I've got to watch it.
Here, Emily and I talked for a while about this new show called Girl Boss, which is quite frankly a pretty bad show about the creation of the successful online store Nasty Gal. Members of the news team have been obsessively binge-watching this show. Emily remarked on how Netflix shows tend to be about 4 episodes too long, which is an observation we can all relate to. And now, back to the questions.
Hi, Emily. I'm Liam. I am curious what you think about new technology used in TV shows lately. Like, a lot of the characters text on screen. They show, like, the actual head of the video camera.
Yeah.
Yeah, what do you think of this? Do you think that's hindering TV? Do you think that's too much technology overload?
Oh, no, I love it. It's fantastic. No, well, for one thing, that's the way people communicate now, and it's a very interesting artistic question. How do you portray that? And I was actually at one point with my husband, who writes about technology, trying to trace what was the earliest show that incorporated texting as an on-screen thing, and how did they do it, and what are elegant ways to show texting? Because in real life, silent texting is actually this tense, complicated thing, you know, where people wait for a text or, like, anyway, one show that did this really, really beautifully is, I don't know if you've seen the British Sherlock, but because Sherlock sort of reconceived the Sherlock story mm-hmm. as having to do with the relationship between ultra cognition and computers, and was also set in a modern London, they had to figure out some way to incorporate, among other things, texting and computers and the use of cell phone cameras and things like that. And I actually thought that show did it really, really well, and I was very interested in the way they did that on screen. But I don't think that was the first show to be doing stuff like that.
Liam and Emily went on a long tangent about the use of videos in TV, particularly in the teen show iCarly, which Liam enjoyed as a kid. This led to a greater conversation about the nature of teen TV shows, a subject which interests Emily a lot.
Personally, very interested in teen shows. It's a lot of what I've written about. My origins as a TV critic are Buffy the Vampire Slayer. I just recently wrote a fairly mean review of Riverdale. And part of it is that I actually don't think of teen shows as junky shows. I mean, I don't have a problem with a fun show that people enjoy, but it's sort of dumb. But I think that some of the best shows on TV have been teen shows, and I don't like when people condescend to a teenager as a main character and assume that therefore the show has to be less thoughtful, be less original. I mean, a lot of times when people talk to me about modern talk, I love The Sopranos, but that is not what created the idea of doing something ambitious on TV. But I think that there's this problem where people only talk about Sopranos-like shows and never talk about these other shows, or talk about them, but in a kind of soft way where they're like, well, that was good too. But no, that was great. And I don't know. This is like a thing that obsesses me. I'm going to write this thing about the parallel muses of the 90s of middle-aged men and teenage girls who are both sort of these parallel lines of shows.
For our next question, OBC Newser Olive opened up the can of worms that is the show Girls, a complicated favorite of Emily's.
it seems like when I read your girls' reviews that they're really like, they're kind of like in conversation with like the rest of the critics, which is really interesting to me because it kind of sounds like something I would read for class, like for an academic paper.
Yeah, no, that's an interesting point about the conversation thing. I actually think of a lot of my writing as overtly or in a way that doesn't show up in conversation with other critics about television, because it's a really vibrant time for TV criticism, not only among official critics, but among just people talking about TV online, which is a big part of the digital change in what TV is. Mm-hmm. Like, the audience is connected to one another. It's weird because I've only written a few pieces about girls, but I have a strange reputation for being, like, the girls' writer. I did not expect to come. I mean, I thought people would be talking about it, but it was pretty intense. I think that show helped to launch a whole set of shows. Like, it was just an inspiration to people about a certain kind of, like, aggressively specific television especially made by women that had a dirty sense of humor, didn't mind upsetting or grossing people out, definitely changed the way bodies are shown on TV. I mean, that show deserves a tremendous amount of credit. Yeah. That said, as I said in my final piece, I am glad it's ending. Mm-hmm. Because it's exhausting. And I have no, you know, involvement in making the show, but it's just been an exhausting thing to experience.
Right.
But I still do remember being in that HBO room and watching the first three episodes, and I described this in the piece about Lena, but I was like, oh my god, like, I loved the first three episodes, but I loved the third episode that ended with her singing Dancing with Myself by Robin. With Marnie. I mean, and actually part of the reason I love that scene, and I once wrote a short blog post about this, is it's so weird because people now think of portrayals of online writing is relatively normal, but I don't think there had ever been on TV where I'd seen somebody write something into a Twitter box, delete it, write another thing, delete it, tweet it, and then turn around and talk to a friend. Like, I know that sounds like a thing that's crazy to rant about, but like, when I saw that, I was like,
really interesting.
This is actually capturing something emotional about the way that people express themselves in a public sense that I've never seen.
All right. Thanks so much to WOBC News for that excellent interview. Hope you enjoyed it. Again, you are listening to WOBC 91.5, Oberlin College and Community Radio. I'm back with Daniel Marcus of the Oberlin Review. Unfortunately, Sydney had to head out, but thanks again so much to her, and happy birthday as well.
That's right.
It was really a privilege to talk with her on a day when I'm sure she could be out doing other things. So thanks thanks for that. Now... we're gonna sort of wind up the rest of the show talking about an event that I think has been on all of our minds. It's something that's really hard to talk about, but the shooting that happened last night in Las Vegas, it's just been absolutely horrendous to hear the news about that. And I think even though it was off in Nevada, it's impacted all of us. So we just sort of had been thinking about that and wanted to talk about that a little bit on air, given how relevant it is right now. If you have thoughts, if it's impacted you in any way, please, we'd love to hear from you. Give us a call at 440-775-8139. Just a couple of the facts on sort of what happened, if you haven't been able to catch up on it yet. It's looking now like it's one of the deadliest, if not the deadliest. Mass shootings in U.S. history, and of course we have a terrible record of that. So that's just it justifies imagination. But last night, I guess Sunday night around 10 p.m., the New York Times has reported that a shooter, Stephen Paddock, was up on the 32nd floor of the Mandalay Bay Resort and Casino, and he had a room full of firearms, at least 17, probably more than that, and he fired down into a crowd below at the Route 91 Harvest Festival, which is a 3-day country music festival that was occurring in Las Vegas on the Strip. Shooting lasted for 10 minutes, and there's some really painful videos you can watch of that event. I would use caution if you're going to do that. It's really powerful in just a horrendous way, and I think it really speaks to the moment that we are at in America and sort of our whole system, how things are going on there. So I'm gonna let Daniel in and see what your thoughts are.
Yeah, I mean, I was the one who really sort of originally pushed for us to talk about this, and I've just been thinking, Johan, a lot about sort of what this means for us, not in the sense of like necessarily people being on our campus who are directly affected. That's sort of a separate thing for me, but I think I'm thinking about it in the sense of, you know, what our campus and what in general the sort of small liberal arts campus can contribute to moving forward mm-hmm. on this issue, because, you know, this is my fourth year here, and gee, in that time there have been, there was Charleston and there was this shooting, Santa Barbara
Sandy Hook
Sandy Hook was 2012.
Okay.
So that's before I got here. But there have been a number of them, and it feels like every time something like that happens, there is sort of a very unique reaction on like a campus like this that really is not happening in the wider world. And I guess what I'm really saying is that there's sort of a more radical sort of understanding of the events. You know, you hear terms that are thrown around like white terrorism and things like that, and how that, you know, how these things, these shootings and the way that we cover them and the way that we address them relate to things like racism and whatnot. And I'm just, I guess, and you don't have to have an answer, but I'm curious, because I feel like, you know, we are really good at having those discussions on our campus amongst one another, or better than we are, you know, out in the general the general public. But I'm sort of curious, do you think that, you know, we students have any ability to sort of shape this going forward? Because I think there's an overwhelming feeling when something like this happens, especially in our country, because it's happened so many times, of total powerlessness.
Mm-hmm.
In part because of the Second Amendment, but in part because, you know, culturally, that's just where we are right now. So I'm curious if you feel like there is something that you know, students have to contribute that can really actually make things happen.
Yeah.
On this issue.
No, I think that's a great perspective to bring to this this issue. And I think it's true that it's really important to have those conversations, and you know, sort of get at the truth of what's happening, and maybe not just sort of the facts which are out there being construed however people want them to be construed.
Right. Right.
And I think, you know, I'm from Minneapolis, and so a lot of people there, when I have conversations about that, are sort of in the same boat. But I think, like you said, it's, you know, that's definitely sort of an anomaly in this country. And, you know, my one sort of personal take on it, which really just floored me, is I took a gap year before I came to Oberlin. Mm-hmm. I was staying with different host families in Europe through, mm-hmm. like, this cultural exchange thing. But I was eating dinner with a French couple, and, you know, we were talking about various things, like, what's your, you know, home like, you know, comparing cultural aspects, and they just sort of dropped the bomb on me, which was, mm-hmm. And I maybe it was because there was a recent mass shooting mm-hmm. that had just occurred.
Yeah.
But they sort of asked me, they're like, so when do you think that America's going to, they basically said, when do you think America's going to figure this out, mm-hmm. And realize why, you know, why this keeps happening,
yeah.
That this is such a terrible problem, and just sort of figure it out. And my response to them, was, I mean, I guess my response to you, which I think I'm pretty depressed about this issue,
yeah.
and just sort of the, like you said, the incredible chain of things coming through, and it doesn't seem like there's the political capital, the political will to, you know, really get out there and make policy changes that are going to be substantive and do something about this. But I think it is still important to have, you know, conversations about what's going on. And like you said, do you have thoughts on how people can sort of utilize those conversations, make a difference?
Yeah, I mean, I don't really have thoughts on how, but it's funny now that you mention it. I think, you know, something like this happens and it reminds me how isolated we are here.
How thick
the bubble is here.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of shocking, in a big way. And I think the only thing that I feel like I know that needs to happen when something like this goes down is that the bubble cannot stay as it is. I'm reminded because Thanksgiving is coming up, fall break is coming up, and people are going to be going home and sitting around their dinner tables. And, you know, in the current political climate that we are in, there is never a time when politics is not a subject of conversation at the dinner table. And I think my intention is that, and not just for this issue, but for all of the ones that have been going on, because I think we as students are in a lot of ways so fortunate to go here because we get surrounded by definitely like a set of perspectives that tend to be a little bit more uniform, for example. Like there is definitely a more liberal perspective, but I think even that being the case, I learn a lot from it. In the past like week, I've learned so much about Puerto Rico and the colonialism of the U.S. government in that country, that like more than I've known my entire life about it. And that's because I get to be here. So I think the very least that we can do, even if it is uncomfortable, is to go home. Like when you go home, have those conversations, because, you know, the opportunities are going to present themselves. And I feel like as much as people are able to and feel like they can do it, you know, without like seriously imperiling their familial relations in some way, I think it's important to do. And I think this is sort of a really grotesque reminder of how that work is not done. Because I think being here it feels like the work is done. You know, you read a Facebook status from your friend that says, you know, we need gun control. Like, it feels like everybody knows that when you're here.
Mm-hmm.
Or it feels like most people know that or believe that. Whether or not that's how it should be is sort of a different discussion. But it feels like everyone feels that way. And I think it's important to remember that everyone does not feel that way. And that when you get out, like, that is your time. Because it's hard to make a change, like, from this campus when everyone sort of feels the way that you do but has classes and homework and can't organize and do all this stuff. Like, it's hard.
Mm-hmm.
So that's sort of my main takeaway. And yeah, I don't know if you have any other thoughts before we sort of move on to our last little segment here.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really good point. And I think sort of the unique nature of these terrible episodes is that, and one way to really sort of make them applicable is that they are applicable. They're applicable to everybody, and that if you watch those videos, it's just it's terrifying because it seems like, you know, a concert that you could have gone to, or and it seems like there's like fireworks or something going off in the background, and then you realize like, no, it's this you know, unimaginable thing.
Yeah.
And it's really, you know, hard to, I mean, it's not hard. It's easy to see that can just sort of, you know, happen wherever. It can happen in a school. You know, my high school, one day almost got shut down. We had like big x-rays and everybody had to, you know, get examined when they came in because we had a gun threat.
Yeah.
So I think those moments when it really intrudes on your life and like, you know, other people that you know, that makes it a powerful time when you can have those conversations and you can say, look at this, this is a thing we need to change. So I think that's a good point with break coming up, things like that. It's a terrible thing, and our thoughts go out to Las Vegas.
Absolutely.
You are listening to WOBC 91.5, Oberlin College and Community Radio. This is The Weekly, and we're going to finish up here with our last segment. What are you excited about? Sort of go around the small horn and see what things are coming up on your radar for this week.
Yeah. I'm assuming that this is the part where I go first, right?
You got it.
Okay. I'm going to have my eyes on the Board of Trustees meeting this weekend, which is in the hotel. What I would give to know what is being said behind those doors. I tell you. I think that never have I really been that interested in a Board of Trustees meeting. But I'm really interested.
Well,
in
folks, if you are a leaker, you know who to call this week.
Yeah, you can email me. My email is managingeditor@oberlinreview.org. I think this is sort of, this feels like a turning point for the entire year, this meeting, because it's the first meeting since that email was sent out. I mean, that email was sent out right after the summer meeting, but it's the first one since then. It's the first one since the hiring freeze was announced. So that feels big to me. And I think, I mean, what am I excited for? I'm excited to go home for fall break. That's what I'm excited for.
Yeah.
That feels like the big keystone issue looking into the next couple weeks for me.
Nice. Yeah. I totally agree. I'm excited. Just so much of what we've talked about these last few weeks has sort of hinged on what's going to happen at that board meeting. So it does feel like we're finally getting to it. We're going to, hopefully, with good transparency from the board, we're going to hear about what goes on and the important decisions made.
Right. Yeah. And it's interesting because, you know, I think my assumption, because I am a pessimist, which if it has not become evident to you on this show by now, I'll just tell you I am a pessimist about this sort of thing. I'm sort of pessimistic about whether we will actually learn anything, but I'm also excited. Like, I would love to be proved wrong this weekend that, like, the Oberlin community is not going to learn anything, whether it's in the sort of spirit of full disclosure or whether we, like, get some juicy nugget from the meeting that we weren't supposed to get, but we got it anyway and it gets published or whatever. You know, who knows what's going to happen, but I would really love to be proved wrong. That would be great.
Yeah, well,
I would love that.
Tune in next week. Read your edition of the Oberlin Review.
And the Grape. We love the Grape.
And the Grape. The Grape, I should say, I'm not sure if you've checked it out, Daniel, but their most recent issue was chock full of really good stories.
Yeah, it was.
So kudos to them. Pleased to have such great journalism on campus.
Pleased to have a show like this. Yeah. I'm so glad that we are able to do this courtesy of WOBC.
Yes.
This is a great honor.
Pat ourselves on the back. I am excited about a couple events coming up this week.
Give it to me.
And sorry to be the continual classical nerd on here, but tomorrow night, the Cleveland Orchestra, one of the premier orchestras in the country, in the world, for that matter.
Oh, is it Rite of Spring tomorrow night?
No, they're playing two Beethoven symphonies,
ooh,
including the fifth. Wow. So if you want to get your dun-dun-dun-duns and go to that.
Yeah.
Tickets are only $10 for students. The first play of the season is going on as well, Circle Mirror Transformation,
That's
weekend. So, I'm going to go see that for sure. And then last plug is that next week we will be talking with Peggy Orenstein.
Yes.
Noted author. Proud Oberlin alumni. We're proud of her.
Indeed.
At least. And she has just a couple, I'm not sure exactly when it was published, but written a New York Times best-selling book called Girls and Sex, which sort of explores the climate currently on campuses around the country in sort of female sexuality, and I'm sure we'll have a conversation about consent, hookup culture, all sorts of things like that. So that should be really exciting. She's going to be speaking next Monday at 7, and we're going to talk to her in the morning and play you a bit of our conversation.
That's right.
So that should be pretty good.
And now you're going to play us out, right?
Yeah. Thank you so much to everyone who tuned in.
Thank you, Johan.
Thank you, Daniel. And thank you, Sydney, and happy birthday. We hope you have a great year ahead. And we hope everyone has a great week ahead. So enjoy your evening.